It's Wednesday, July the 23rd. It's the NPR News Update, and I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for coming along today. I have stories about when we will know about the price of health insurance for the coming year, for-profit schools that allegedly misled students, a bizarre court case involving a northeastern Minnesota prosecutor, and plans to cut carbon emissions across the region. Also, we'll hear a chat with the U.S. Ag Secretary, and we hear about what Minnesota is doing to help the Central American kids showing up on the Mexico border. First, five BWCA campers were rescued after being injured during storms Monday night and yesterday morning in northeastern Minnesota. Peter Cox reports.
Mark Zupp, owner of Zupp's Fishing Resort and Canoe Outfitters on Loch LaCroix Lake, got a call around 3:30 a.m. Tuesday that two campers had been hit by downed trees in the BWCA. At first light, he jumped in a boat.
It's about 26 miles to where that site is, into the boundary waters. It took us about 35, 40 minutes to get there. Got in there, and there was two people severely injured that we had to get out as soon as we could. It's probably a 1 in 10 year storm.
The St. Louis County Sheriff's Office says 47-year-old Kirk Sanchez and 13-year-old Hayden Toops, both of Louisiana, were injured by trees falling on their tents. Zupp took them by boat to a nearby portage, where an ambulance drove them to a hospital. Two women with serious injuries were flown from the Loon Lake area. The St. Louis County Rescue Squad says the women had trees lying on them for several hours. One of the women was airlifted to a Duluth area hospital. Another woman had non-life-threatening injuries. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
DFL Governor Mark Dayton says he now wants new information about how much it will cost to buy health insurance next year on Minnesota's online health exchange to be made public before the November election. Dayton had previously sounded reluctant to release the MinSure rates until the start of the next open enrollment period, which is November 15th after the election. Republicans contended the governor finally bowed to mounting political pressure. Tim Pugmire has more.
In a letter to lawmakers serving on a MinSure oversight panel, Dayton said the rate information should be released around October 1st if all the health plans agree. It was a quick about-face for Dayton, who just a day earlier said he wasn't sure if the rate should come out before Election Day, when voters will decide if he serves a second term. He said the rates would only add to the political shots coming from his Republican critics.
I think they're going to be so badly distorted for the political purposes that I don't think they're going to shed any light for consumers.
But now Dayton believes it could shed some light. In the letter, he said that getting the information out early will provide additional time for families and businesses to make informed decisions about their health coverage options. However, Dayton cautioned that the Department of Commerce just received the health plan's initial rate proposals, which must now go through a formal process of review, negotiation, and approval. The final information will then go to MinSure for input into its system. During a meeting of the MinSure Legislative Oversight Committee, Republican Representative Joe Hoppe of Chaska said he was pleased with Dayton's turnaround.
It was nice to see the letter come from the governor. I think we all agree at the table that the earlier we can get the rates out and give people the more time to look at them, the better.
Deputy Commerce Commissioner Tim VandeHay told members of the committee that he's optimistic about getting the rates out early.
I do appreciate that the governor acknowledged in there that really it is important for this process to continue and to be completed, as that's the best process we know of to provide reasonable, cost-effective rates to our citizens. At this point in time, I believe that there is a reasonable expectation that we would have it ready for October 1st and that we will certainly make all efforts to comply with that request.
MinSure is a key campaign issue for Republicans who blame Dayton and other Democrats for the troubled rollout of the exchange and its website. They've also been pushing hard for an early release of rates that many expect to be higher next year than this year. One of those critics, Republican Senator Michelle Benson of Ham Lake, said Dayton is doing the right thing.
I think political pressure in an election year did make a difference. He was going to be beat up over the rates, whether they were released or not, and hiding them makes it look like he's manipulating the system. And so I'm glad that he is being transparent made the right decision.
DFL Representative Joe Atkins of Invergrove Heights, a co-chair of the oversight panel, said he too wants the rates available to consumers before the enrollment period begins. But Atkins said he didn't view the release date as a political calculation.
The real issue was, in terms of the rate release, is giving Commerce the amount of time that it needed to actuarially review the rates and then go through the approval process and negotiation to make sure we get the lowest rates possible.
Atkins said he wants the Oversight Committee to meet next on the same day as the MNsure rates come out. He said lawmakers could then compare those costs to this year and compare Minnesota's rates to neighboring states.
Tim Pugmire for us. Two Woodbury-based for-profit schools are drawing the ire of Minnesota Attorney General Lori Swanson for allegedly misleading students about the jobs they could land after graduation. Swanson filed suit against the schools yesterday, charging they deceived students into believing programs at the institutions could lead to careers in law enforcement. But the schools insist they did not misrepresent the programs. Martin Moylan reports.
Attorney General Swanson says students were told programs at the Minnesota School of Business and Globe University prepared enrollees to be police or probation officers at a cost of up to $70,000. But Swanson says the programs lack certifications required in Minnesota. She says that has left some students with tens of thousands of dollars of debt and no prospect of landing the jobs they hope for.
If you go through that two-year degree or if you go through that four-year degree, you cannot apply to be a police officer. You'd have to start college all over again at a properly certified and properly recognized institution.
The attorney general is seeking to stop allegedly deceptive marketing practices. She also wants civil penalties against the schools and restitution for students. Swanson says she has 40 affidavits from students who say they were misled about law enforcement and other programs offered by Globe University and the Minnesota School of Business. One of their unhappy customers was Dylan Zerwas. Within a few weeks of enrolling, he says he quickly pulled out of the Minnesota School of Business after a discussion with a substitute teacher.
I told him I want to be a police officer. He told me, we can't be one in Minnesota. We're not accredited. And I was dumbstruck. I didn't understand.
The schools issued a statement blasting the attorney general's lawsuit as unwarranted. The schools said they have cooperated with Swanson's inquiry into their business, marketing, and admissions practices and made several attempts to address any concerns. The institution said admissions representatives and a course catalog state that the criminal justice program does not meet the standards and training requirements for aspiring police officers. So far this year, the Minnesota Office of Higher Education has received 30 complaints about for-profit schools. Most have to do with billing and other money matters, but none have concerned the law enforcement programs that have drawn the Attorney General's attention. Office of Higher Education Director Larry Pogemiller says his office will take a closer look at the Globe University and Minnesota School of Business.
We will now do our part to go and look and see what we can find out to protect students. We'll double-check their websites, their materials.
Pokermiller says he wonders if his office is missing problems at for-profit schools and might employ secret shoppers and other techniques to get a better read on their performance.
Obviously, there's not enough resources to check in on every recruiter or every campus in the state, and so we feel we need to be more aggressive. But we don't always know exactly where to look until you get something like this, a direct student complaint.
Nationwide, for-profit schools have been the subject of about 60 government lawsuits and investigations in the past decade. Robin Smith is an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center.
Certainly, attorney general's offices in some states are being a lot more active about filing lawsuits against schools that are engaging in the kinds of misrepresentations that the Minnesota Attorney General has targeted.
But Smith says many students don't know they can complain about schools that deceive and exploit them. And she says state agencies need to do a better job overseeing for-profit schools. The Attorney General says people may report problems about for-profit schools by calling her office or visiting the AG's website.
Marty Moylan on the NPR News Update. The jury in the Jesse Ventura defamation case reconvened this morning after closing arguments in the case yesterday. Ventura says a story about him in a best-selling book is wrong, and his attorney says the former governor is entitled to restitution. You can check for a verdict at nprnews.org. Attorneys made their opening statements yesterday at the St. Louis County Courthouse in Duluth in a case accusing Cook County Attorney Tim Scannell of criminal sexual conduct. Scannell is accused of having inappropriate sexual contact 2 summers ago with a 17-year-old girl when he was 46. You may also remember Scannell's name from an incident in 2011. That's when he was shot 3 times at point-blank range in the Cook County Courthouse by a Grand Marais man he had just successfully prosecuted for criminal sexual conduct in a Grand Marais case with a teenage girl. Reporter Dan Crocker was at the trial yesterday, and he talked with Tom Cran.
First, describe the charges here that Tim Scannell faces.
So Mr. Scannell is charged with 2 felony counts of criminal sexual conduct in the 4th degree. Now, there are several elements to those charges: that he intimately touched the alleged victim on 2 occasions in August 2012 with sexual intent, and that at the time she was between 16 and 18 years old, and that the defendant at the time was at least 4 years older and in a position of authority over her. And much of today focused on that last part, on their relationship and whether or not he was indeed in that position of authority over her.
So tell us how the prosecution is trying to make their case.
Prosecutor Tom Heffelfinger, who's a former U.S. attorney for Minnesota, so he's trying the case. Normally, Tim Scannell, as county attorney, would prosecute, but obviously they had to bring in an outside prosecutor in this case. So Heffelfinger spent a lot of time trying to establish the depth of the relationship between Scannell and the alleged victim. He said he acted as a mentor, a father figure. He was her tennis and soccer coach. He taught her guitar. He counseled her on academic issues. And then for several months around the time of the alleged incidents, they spent a lot of time together because he was advising her on colleges. So the prosecution argues that all that demonstrates that Scannell was in a position of authority over her for years and that she trusted him. And then Heffelfinger laid out how Scannell proceeded to develop what he called an obsession with the alleged victim, how they spent more and more time together, they emailed, they texted, and that all eventually led to what Heffelfinger described as a campaign by Scannell to develop a sexual relationship with her, and that eventually culminated in the 2 alleged incidents.
So how did Scannell's attorney frame this case?
So his defense attorney, Joseph Tamburino, he presented a very different picture of events. He said that first the alleged victim testified before a grand jury last year, and she said then that at the time of the events, she didn't think Scannell was in a position of authority, and she didn't think that Scannell had a parental role at the time. And then furthermore, Tamburino says that when the alleged victim was interviewed by state investigators, that back then she admitted they kissed and hugged, but said that they had not engaged in any sexual contact. So the defense doesn't deny that Scannell had feelings for the girl, that he told her he loved her, that they hugged, that they kissed, but they do deny that there was illegal sexual conduct as defined by the law, and they also argue that Scannell was not in a position of authority at the time the events took place.
I understand the alleged victim testified today.
She did. She was on the stand for nearly 3 hours, and they spent a lot of time, again, establishing the significant role that Scannell played in her life as a father figure, it was described. Then she very quietly detailed the alleged incidents. She talked about how they would go for drives and park frequently on a dirt road outside town where the alleged incidents took place. Then she talked about how it's had a detrimental effect on her in her first year away at college. And she talked about how it's torn apart the close family friendships between her family and the Scannell family and 2 other families, and that she wishes it could all go back to the way it used to be. And she'll be cross-examined, I should say, tomorrow.
Now tell us what kind of impact that this trial, this case, has had on Cook County and in Grand Marais.
It's been huge. First of all, that shooting back in 2011 was enormous news when Mr. Scannell was shot. He did survive, but the shooter, Dan Schlins, he later died in jail. And then that case brought to the surface what had long been the simmering issue in the area about how older men would sexually pursue teen girls and how for years law enforcement couldn't get anyone to talk about it. So when Scannell was first accused of having an inappropriate relationship with a teenage girl, there was a lot of shock, obviously, and there was even a local campaign to have Scannell step down from office in Grand Marais.
All right, and very quickly, Dan, what's next?
The trial is expected to last a week, and Mr. Scannell is expected to testify in the trial on his own defense.
Dan Crocker reporting from Duluth for us. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Dan Crocker and Tom Cran on All Things Considered. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency will hold hearings in four cities next week. It's seeking input on a plan to cut carbon emissions from power plants. None of the cities are in Minnesota, so supporters of the proposed carbon rules held a hearing of their own yesterday in St. Paul. Elizabeth Dunbar reports.
Nearly all of the 24 people who spoke at the hearing praised the EPA's rules, saying that cutting power plant carbon emissions should be the first step in addressing climate change.
I'm here because I care. I care about what we're leaving for my kids and my grandkids, these guys.
Les Rogers, a retired engineer from Falcon Heights, held up a picture of his grandchildren and says he was surprised to see that power plants account for the largest share of carbon emissions in the U.S., nearly 40%.
So I really came today to ask all of our leaders and all the people in this room to strongly support the Clean Energy Plan and ask the EPA, let's just get it done.
Many young people spoke, including McAllister College student Abby Royce.
Climate change is not just an environmental problem. It's a public health issue. It's an economic issue. It's really very, very multifaceted, and a lot of people don't really want to address that. You know, it's just, you know, the polar bears, or it's, you know, but it really does address basically everything about human existence.
DFL State Senator John Marty says Minnesota should be thinking about how to free itself from fossil fuels altogether. He says no matter the final reduction target, the state is well positioned to meet it.
It's interesting to have them say maybe they're not counting things right, but even the way they are counting, Minnesota is going to do well, and I think it's important we do well, not because we have to do well because of a federal regulation, but because we have to do well for environment and public health and economic reasons as well.
But the utilities and business groups are holding off on sending their comments to the EPA until they understand the details better. Tony Quillis of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce says there are a lot of unanswered questions about how Minnesota's goal was calculated. He says it matters because parts of Minnesota's economy are energy intensive, such as the taconite industry. If reducing carbon emissions results in higher electricity costs, Quillis says that could be a problem.
We have to remain competitive with Brazil and Chile and all those other foreign countries in terms of steel. And if we keep increasing the costs on our guys, it kind of hurts them to be competitive.
Renewable energy advocates counter, saying we've reached a point where wind and solar can compete against fossil fuels and win out on price. The EPA is taking public comments on the carbon emissions rules through October 16th. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Rural America is in the spotlight at the White House. Today and tomorrow, the Obama administration is holding a conference designed to increase private sector investment in rural areas. It will essentially act as matchmaker, bringing together major investors with rural business leaders, government officials, and economic development experts. The conference is part of a larger effort by the White House launched in 2011 to create stronger rural communities. Tom Cran talked about it last night with the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack.
Now, give us some examples of what kinds of projects you would like to see investment in, especially ones that would benefit people in rural Minnesota.
Well, let me just talk about the Farm Credit Administration that recently announced eight banks from the Farm Credit System announced the creation of a $150 million equity fund that's going to be operated by Advantage Capital. They're going to basically are open for business, and if you're a small business in rural Minnesota, you're looking for additional investment in that business. This is an equity fund that you could potentially go to, and they may be able to, and willing to invest in your business. There may be you may be a small town, you may be a mayor or a city manager or administrator in a small town. You have a water project. It's a revenue stream because folks pay their water bill, but you just don't have the resources yet to be able to build that new treatment facility that you'd like to have or expand your water capacity. So it's possible that as a result of this conference, you may find a partner who's willing to essentially finance that water project over a long period of time. It may be a pension plan. It may be an endowment that sees this as a stable and secure income-producing asset for them for a considerable period of time. So there are literally hundreds of these kinds of opportunities that are occurring in rural America every single day. We want to make sure that those who are operating large funds are aware of these opportunities, and I think if they are, they'll invest in them.
We've been hearing about the issue of population loss in smaller towns, rural areas for years, but then we also hear that there are examples here in Minnesota and elsewhere about 30- and 40-year-olds moving back to small towns. But as you see it, how severe is that population drain and often brain drain in rural America?
Well, I think it's significant. I think it's significant in agriculture because of the aging nature of farmers, and I think it is of concern when we actually see the overall population in rural America decline for the first time in our history. There are reasons why we need to do a better job of marketing the opportunities that exist in rural America. It's not a situation where there's a lack of opportunity. I think there's just a lack of understanding and appreciation for the opportunity, and that's what this conference is designed to sort of reawaken people to those opportunities. You know, there's a lot of innovative and creative entrepreneurship that's taking place. If you see the local and regional food system operation, which is one of the fastest growing aspects of agriculture today, you see this as a very innovative and very entrepreneurial area, but it needs credit, it needs capital, and it's having a difficult time finding that. That's why we're having the conference in the hopes of educating people about one of the fastest growing aspects of agriculture.
When you look at this upcoming conference, the people who'll be there and the possible projects that come out of it, what are you most excited about? What sorts of matchmaking opportunities here do you see as having real potential?
Well, I'm most excited about two things. One, that the focus will actually be on an important part of America that I think for far too long has been not fully appreciated. And then secondly, I think there will be significant commitments being made by commercial and investment banking institutions to say, hey, we now recognize this is an opportunity we want to take full advantage of. We want the rest of the country to join with us in making a significant commitment. And I think that will send a ripple of hope, if you will, out to rural communities. It'll spur a lot of creative thought and a lot of excitement at local and state levels. And partnerships are going to be formed within the conference and outside of the conference. I just think there's a catalytic effect of this, which I think is exciting. You know, the fact that we've already had $150 million equity fund set up because of this, I think is just the sort of the tip of the iceberg.
Tom Vilsack is the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Thank you very much, Secretary Vilsack, for speaking with us from Washington today. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
Tom Vilsack and Tom Cran on All Things Considered. A wave of children pouring into the southern U.S. from Central America has overwhelmed the immigration system in recent months. This week, Congressman Keith Ellison called a meeting to discuss how Minnesota should prepare for the possible influx of these young immigrants. He says the state has the capacity to help and should. John Keller is the executive director of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. He joined Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition.
The meeting this week was to look at resources and preparations if more of these children arrive. Is Minnesota in a good position to help them?
Minnesota, when you look at us compared to other states nationally, is very strong in the nonprofit sector and social services sector. It's one of the reasons why when you compare, again, nationally, we always do a good job in terms of taking care of vulnerable people. And I know that the resources and safety net that Immigrant Law Center and many other good nonprofits are a part of are prepared and willing to do everything we can for these young people.
Any idea, John, and any estimated number of how many unaccompanied children could come to Minnesota?
In most of the northern states, what we have always experienced is reunification of families, and we don't expect there'll be much different in this case. About 85% of unaccompanied minors are ultimately resettled with a family member, and that makes sense. It keeps people out of state or federal custody. It gives them an alternative to being in detention that also is the healthiest place for these kids to be, and we have already seen for the last several years, as the numbers of minors have been increasing, that trend will continue. We expect that is what will happen here with Minnesota as well.
How does this group differ from other refugee populations already in Minnesota, like the Hmong and Somalis?
Well, I think there's a couple important distinctions and a couple important similarities. First and foremost, there has been no formal declaration by an international body that these are refugees, so they're not officially declared refugees by the United Nations. That being said, to a child who's fleeing, you know, the murder capital of the world in Honduras or Guatemala or El Salvador that are ranked number 4 and number 5, the same exact factors, fearing for your life and being unable to be safe in your home country, that have affected refugees like the Hmong and the Somali and the Karen, who also have resettled here in Minnesota, are exactly the same factors that are pushing these kids out of extremely dangerous circumstances.
There are federal resettlement monies available. St. Paul, Rochester Public Schools get some of that money, as you know, so do other Minnesota groups. And the feds, as I understand, are signaling that some of that money will be redirected to help these unaccompanied minors. How might that affect how groups in Minnesota are helping refugees?
The president has asked for almost $4 billion in additional monies, most of those going to both enforcement as well as housing for the refugee resettlement offices, and also to the court system. The court system, in terms of immigration, is 2% of the overall enforcement budget, and we had a crisis in the immigration court system long before the situation on the southern border today. The average wait for somebody who's going through immigration court is 578 days these days, so over 2 years here in Minnesota and nationwide just to get your final hearing and have a chance to tell your case to the judge. When you add on to that system a new wave of about 40,000 young people and adults that have come through the southern border, you would think that there would be an interest by Congress to look at how do we speed things up. But unfortunately, we're seeing this issue being politicked in an extremely cynical and negative fashion.
And you're comfortable saying that Minnesota has the capacity at this point to help these kids?
At this point, you know, I would remind listeners that we have not seen, you know, anything like what's happening at the southern border in Minnesota. We are still in the beginning process of seeing young people, and I would say a small number of young people being resettled with family who are already residing in Minnesota.
Always good talking to you, John Keller. Thank you so much.
Oh, my very pleasure.
John Keller and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. I'm Phil Picardi, Morning Edition newscaster and occasional host. I also do the NPR News Update. Thanks for listening to it. More on the podcast tomorrow.